Chapter 28. Having occasion to transact some business with a solicitor who occupies a highly suicidal set of chambers in Gray's Inn, I afterwards took a turn in the large square of that stronghold of melancholy, reviewing, with congenial surroundings, my experiences of chambers. I began, as was natural, with the chambers I had just left. They were an upper set on a rotten staircase, with a mysterious bunker bulkhead on the landing outside them, of a rather nautical and screw collier-like appearance than otherwise, and painted an intense black. Many moldy years have passed since the appropriation of this Davy Jones locker to any purpose, and during the whole period within the memory of living man, it has been asked and padlocked. I cannot quite satisfy my mind whether it was originally meant for the reception of coals, or bodies, or as a place of temporary security for the plunder looted by laundresses, but I incline to the last opinion. It is about breast high, and usually serves as a bulk for defendants in reduced circumstances to lean against and ponder at, when they come on the hopeful errand of trying to make an arrangement without money, under which auspicious circumstances it mostly happens that the legal gentleman they want to see is much engaged, and they pervade the staircase for a considerable period. Against this opposing bulk, in the absurdest manner, the tomb-like outer door of the solicitor's chambers, which is also of an intense black, stands in dark ambush, half open and half shut, all day. The solicitor's apartments are three in number, consisting of a slice, a cell, and a wedge. The slice is assigned to the two clerks, the cell is occupied by the principal, and the wedge is devoted to stray papers, old game baskets from the country, a washing stand, and a model of a patent ship's caboose which was exhibited in Chancery at the commencement of the present century on an application for an injunction to restrain infringement. At about 9:30 on every weekday morning, the younger of the two clerks, who, I have reason to believe, leads the fashion at Pentonville in the articles of pipes and shirts, may be found knocking the dust out of his official door key on the bunker locker before mentioned. And so exceedingly subject to dust is his key, and so very retentive of that superfluity, that in exceptional summer weather, when a ray of sunlight has fallen on the locker in my presence, I have noticed its inexpressive countenance to be deeply marked by a kind of brama or erysipelas or smallpox. This set of chambers, as I have gradually discovered, when I have had restless occasion to make inquiries or leave messages after office hours, is under the charge of a lady named Sweeney, in figure extremely like an old family umbrella, whose dwelling confronts a dead wall in a court off Gray's Inn Lane, and who is usually fetched into the passage of that bower, when wanted, from some neighboring home of industry, which has the curious property of imparting an inflammatory appearance to her visage. Mrs. Sweeney is one of the race of professed laundresses, and is the compiler of a remarkable manuscript volume entitled Apostrophe Mrs. Sweeney's Book, apostrophe from which much curious statistical information may be gathered respecting the high prices and small uses of soda, soap, sand, firewood, and other such articles. I have created a legend in my mind, and consequently I believe it with the utmost pertinacity, that the late Mr. Sweeney was a ticket porter under the Honorable Society of Gray's Inn, and that, in consideration of his long and valuable services, Mrs. Sweeney was appointed to her present post. For, though devoid of personal charms, I have observed this lady to exercise a fascination over the elderly ticker porter mind, particularly under the gateway, and in corners and entries, which I can only refer to her being one of the fraternity, yet not competing with it. All that need be said concerning this set of chambers is said, when I have added that it is in a large double house in Gray's Inn Square, very much out of repair, and that the outer portal is ornamented in a hideous manner with certain stone remains, which have the appearance of the dismembered bust, torso, and limbs of a petrified bencher. Indeed, I look upon Gray's Inn generally as one of the most depressing institutions in brick and mortar, known to the children of men. Can anything be more dreary than its arid square, Sahara Desert of the Law, with the ugly old tile-topped tenements, the dirty windows, the bills to let, the doorposts inscribed like gravestones, the crazy gateway giving upon the filthy lane, the scowling, iron-barred prison-like passage in two Verulam buildings, the moldy red-nosed ticket porters with little coffin plates, and why with aprons, the dry, hard, atomy-like appearance of the whole dust heap? When my uncommercial travels tend to this dismal spot, my comfort is its rickety state. Imagination gloats over the fullness of time, when the staircases shall have quite tumbled down. They are daily wearing into an ill-savored powder, but have not quite tumbled down, yet when the last old prolix venture all of the olden time, shall have been got out of an upper window by means of a fire ladder, and carried off to the Holborn Union. When the last clerk shall have engrossed the last parchment behind the last splash on the last of the mud-stained windows, which, all through the miry year, are pilloried out of recognition in Gray's Inn Lane. Then, shall a squalid little trench, with rank grass and a pump in it, lying between the coffee house and South Square, be wholly given up to cats and rats, and not, as now, have its empire divided between those animals, and a few briefless bipeds surely called to the bar by voices of deceiving spirits, seeing that they are wanted there by no mortal who glance down, with eyes better glazed than their casements, from their dreary and lackluster rooms. Then shall the way nor westward, now lying under a short grim colonnade, where in summer time pounce flies from law stationering windows into the eyes of laymen, be choked with rubbish and happily become impassable. Then shall the gardens where turf, trees, and gravel wear a legal livery of black, run rank, and pilgrims go to Gorhambury, to see Bacon's effigy as he sat, and not come here, which in truth they seldom do, to see where he walked. Then, in a word, shall the old established vendor of periodicals sit alone in his little crib of a shop behind the Holborn Gate, like that lumbering Marius among the ruins of Carthage, who has sat heavy on a thousand million of similes. At one period of my uncommercial career I much frequented another set of chambers in Gray's Inn Square. They were what is familiarly called a top set, apostrophe and all the eatables and drinkables introduced into them acquired a flavor of cocklift. I have known an unopened Strasbourg pate fresh from Fortnum and Mason's, to draw in this cocklift tone through its crockery dish, and become penetrated with cocklift to the core of its inmost truffle in 3/4 of an hour. This, however, was not the most curious feature of those chambers. That consisted in the profound conviction entertained by my esteemed friend Parkle, their tenant, that they were clean. Whether it was an inborn hallucination, or whether it was imparted to him by Mrs. Miggott the laundress, I never could ascertain. But, I believe he would have gone to the stake upon the question. Now, they were so dirty, that I could take off the distinctest impression of my figure on any article of furniture by merely lounging upon it for a few moments, and it used to be a private amusement of mine to print myself off, if I may use the expression, all over the rooms. It was the first large circulation I had. At other times I have accidentally shaken a window curtain, while in animated conversation with Parkle, and struggling insects which were certainly red, and were certainly not ladybirds, have dropped on the back of my hand. Yet Parkle lived in that top set years, bound body and soul to the superstition, that they were clean. He used to say, when congratulated upon them, "Well, they are not like chambers in one respect, you know. They are clean." Apostrophe concurrently, he had an idea which he could never explain, that Mrs. Miggott was in some way connected with the church. When he was in particularly good spirits, he used to believe that a deceased uncle of hers had been a dean. When he was poorly and low, he believed that her brother had been a curate. I and Mrs. Miggott, she was a genteel woman, were on confidential terms, but I never knew her to commit herself to any distinct assertion on the subject, She merely claimed a proprietorship in the church, by looking when it was mentioned, as if the reference awakened the slumbering past, and were personal. It may have been his amiable confidence in Mrs. Miggott's better days that inspired my friend with his delusion respecting the chambers, but he never wavered in his fidelity to it for a moment, though he wallowed in dirt 7 years. Two of the windows of these chambers look down into the garden, and we have sat up there together many a summer evening, saying how pleasant it was, and talking of many things. To my intimacy with that top set, I am indebted for three of my liveliest personal impressions of the loneliness of life in chambers. They shall follow here, in order, first, second, and third. First, my Gray's Inn friend, on a time, hurt one of his legs, and it became seriously inflamed. Not knowing of his indisposition, I was on my way to visit him as usual one summer evening, when I was much surprised by meeting a lively leech in Field Court, Gray's Inn, seemingly on his way to the West End of London. As the leech was alone, and was of course unable to explain his position, even if he had been inclined to do so, which he had not the appearance of being, I passed him and went on. Turning the corner of Gray's Inn Square, I was beyond expression amazed by meeting another leech also entirely alone, and also proceeding in a westerly direction, though with less decision of purpose. Ruminating on this extraordinary circumstance, and endeavoring to remember whether I had ever read, in the Philosophical Transactions or any work on natural history, of a migration of leeches, I ascended to the top set, past the dreary series of closed outer doors of offices, and an empty set or two, which intervened between that lofty region and the surface. Entering my friend's rooms, I found him stretched upon his back, like Prometheus bound, with a perfectly demented ticket porter in attendance on him instead of the vulture. Which helpless individual, who was feeble and frightened, and had, my friend explained to me, in great choler, been endeavoring for some hours to apply leeches to his leg, and as yet had only got on 2 out of 20. To this unfortunate's distraction between a damp cloth on which he had placed the leeches to freshen them, and the wrathful adjurations of my friend to stick 'em on, sir. I referred the phenomenon I had encountered. The rather as two fine specimens were at that moment going out at the door, while a general insurrection of the rest was in progress on the table. After a while our united efforts prevailed, and, when the leeches came off, and had recovered their spirits, we carefully tied them up in a decanter. But I never heard more of them than that they were all gone next morning, and that the out-of-door young man of Bickle, Bush, and Bodger, on the ground floor, had been bitten and blooded by some creature not identified. They never took on Mrs. Miggott, the laundress. But, I have always preserved fresh the belief that she unconsciously carried several about her, until they gradually found openings in life. Second, on the same staircase with my friend Parkle, and on the same floor, there lived a man of law who pursued his business elsewhere, and used those chambers as his place of residence. For 3 or 4 years, Parkle rather knew of him than knew him, but after that four Englishmen short pause of consideration, they began to speak. Parkle exchanged words with him in his private character only, and knew nothing of his business ways, or means. He was a man a good deal about town, but always alone. We used to remark to one another that although we often encountered him in theaters, concert rooms, and similar public places, he was always alone. Yet he was not a gloomy man, and was of a decidedly conversational turn, insomuch that he would sometimes of an evening lounge with a cigar in his mouth, half in and half out of Parkle's rooms, and discuss the topics of the day by the hour. He used to hint on these occasions that he had four faults to find with life. Firstly, that it obliged a man to be always winding up his watch. Secondly, that London was too small. Thirdly, that it therefore wanted variety. Fourthly, that there was too much dust in it. There was so much dust in his own faded chambers, certainly, that they reminded me of a sepulchre, furnished in prophetic anticipation of the present time, which had newly been brought to light, after having remained buried a few thousand years. One dry, hot autumn evening at twilight, this man, being then 5 years turned of 50, looked in upon Parkle in his usual lounging way, with his cigar in his mouth as usual, and said, "I am going out of town." Apostrophe as he never went out of town, Parkle said, "Oh indeed. At last?" Apostrophe apostrophe yes, apostrophe says he, "At last. For what is a man to do? London is so small. If you go west, you come to Hounslow. If you go east, you come to Bow. If you go south, there's Brixton or Norwood. If you go north, you can't get rid of Barnet. Then, the monotony of all the streets, streets, streets and of all the roads, roads, roads and the dust, dust, dust." Apostrophe apostrophe when he had said this, he wished Parkle a good evening, but came back again and said, with his watch in his hand, "Oh, I really cannot go on winding up this watch over and over again. I wish you would take care of it." Apostrophe so, Parkle laughed and consented, and the man went out of town. The man remained out of town so long, that his letterbox became choked, and no more letters could be got into it, and they began to be left at the lodge, and to accumulate there. At last the head porter decided, on conference with the steward, to use his master key and look into the chambers, and give them the benefit of a whiff of air. Then, it was found, that he had hanged himself to his bedstead, and had left this written memorandum: "I should prefer to be cut down by my neighbor and friend, if he will allow me to call him so, H. Parkle Esquire apostrophe." This was an end of Parkle's occupancy of chambers. He went into lodgings immediately. Third, while Parkle lived in Gray's Inn, and I myself was uncommercially preparing for the bar, which is done, as everybody knows, by having a frayed old gown put on in a pantry by an old woman in a chronic state of St. Anthony's fire and dropsy, and, so decorated, bolting a bad dinner in a party of four, whereof each individual mistrusts the other three, I say, while these things were, there was a certain elderly gentleman who lived in a court of the temple, and was a great judge and lover of port wine. Every day he dined at his club, and drank his bottle or two of port wine, and every night came home to the temple, and went to bed in his lonely chambers. This had gone on many years without variation, when one night he had a fit on coming home, and fell and cut his head deep, but partly recovered and groped about in the dark to find the door. When he was afterwards discovered dead, it was clearly established by the marks of his hands about the room, that he must have done so. Now, this chanced on the night of Christmas Eve, and over him lived a young fellow who had sisters and young country friends, and who gave them a little party that night, in the course of which they played at blindman's buff. They played that game, for their greater sport, by the light of the fire only, and once, when they were all quietly rustling and stealing about, and the blindman was trying to pick out the prettiest sister, for which I am far from blaming him, somebody cried, "Hark! The man below must be playing blindman's buff by himself tonight." They listened, and they heard sounds of someone falling about and stumbling against furniture, and they all laughed at the conceit, and went on with their play, more light-hearted and merry than ever. Thus, those two so different games of life and death were played out together, blindfolded, in the two sets of chambers. Such are the occurrences, which, coming to my knowledge, imbued me long ago with a strong sense of the loneliness of chambers. There was a fantastic illustration to much the same purpose implicitly believed by a strange sort of man now dead, whom I knew when I had not quite arrived at legal years of discretion, though I was already in the uncommercial line. This was a man who, though not more than 30, had seen the world in divers irreconcilable capacities, had been an officer in a South American regiment among other odd things, but had not achieved much in any way of life, and was in debt, and in hiding. He occupied chambers of the dreariest nature in Lion's Inn. His name, however, was not upon the door or doorpost, but in lieu of it stood the name of a friend who had died in the chambers, and had given him the furniture. The story arose out of the furniture, and was to this effect. Let the former holder of the chambers, whose name was still upon the door and doorpost, be Mr. Testator. Mr. Testator took a set of chambers in Lion's Inn, when he had but very scanty furniture for his bedroom, and none for his sitting room. He had lived some wintry months in this condition, and had found it very bare and cold. One night, past midnight, when he sat writing, and still had writing to do that must be done, before he went to bed, he found himself out of coals. He had coals downstairs, but had never been to his cellar. However, the cellar key was on his mantel shelf, and if he went down, and opened the cellar it fitted, he might fairly assume the coals in that cellar to be his. As to his laundress, she lived among the coal wagons and... Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.